is Stephanie Weiner. My husband, Joe Osbaker, and I, on this day last year, were part of the houses that were raided on September 24th at 7 in the morning. We're also part of the 23 who were subpoenaed and all refused to testify.
We're your co-MCs for the event today. And I'm Sarah Smith. I'm also one of the 23 who was subpoenaed to the federal grand jury, and also I refuse to testify. We're going to have a lot of excellent speakers today, and we're going to start off with Bernadine Dorn. She has been a clinical professor of law at the Children and Family Justice Center at Northwestern University School of Law. She's been doing that for the past 21 years, in which she teaches and works in youth justice and international human rights law. She was a national leader of the SDS, and also she was on the FBI's 10 Most Wanted list. She's also... She's also a grand jury resister. So everyone, please welcome Bernadine Dorn.
Thank you, Sarah. Thank you. Good morning, everybody. This is really a great, it's odd to have something involving grand jury subpoenas be a celebratory moment. But the fact that there has been 100% resistance among the people subpoenaed, and that it's a year later and everybody is still organizing and active and out of jail is an incredible victory. We should just savor the moment and recognize it for what it is, a great piece of organizing, an important victory, a lot of allies mobilized around this. So let's give everybody a big hand. I'm gonna just talk briefly, and I have to run to a Lawyers Guild event, so I'm gonna embarrass myself by talking and running. But I thought I'd begin actually with my own historical grand jury resistance thing. It's a little bit of history for those of you who weren't there and don't remember. But I was subpoenaed to a federal grand jury in May of 1982 in New York City. So I have a kind of an odd specialty in this very arcane and obsolete and dangerous specialty of the law, grand jury law and grand jury resistance. And so at that time, it was, I think about 18 people were subpoenaed after the Brinks robbery and the deaths that resulted from the Brinks robbery. And we all refused to testify. At the time of my subpoena, our sons were 5 years old, 2 and 1. So for me, it was the worst year of my life, I think I could say. I don't know how Stephanie and Joe feel about it or the other people here, but in any event, we didn't just refuse, we refused and went into the courtroom. These guys didn't even go into the courtroom, which I think is very smart. But at the time of the subpoena, my 5-year-old accompanied me to federal court the day of the subpoena. And after the judge lectured me about the rule of law and my defiance of the rule of law, declared me in civil contempt, Zaid was amazed watching me be pulled by the federal marshals into the bowels of the federal courtroom and not to reemerge for almost 8 months, just shy of 8 months. My children visited every week. This was in the and different people, steady friends, brought them to visit me. The oldest sat on my lap and we did crossword puzzles and made calendars and read books. And then he would go outside with the first friend who brought him and wait until I went into my cell and flashed my lights at him down on the street. I have most vivid memories of this. My middle child would come to visit at a different time, and his habit then, he was 2, was to jump into my lap and immediately go to sleep, which for me was the most satisfying of all that whole year, just to smell him and hold him. The youngest was struggling, and so we tried to just play toddler games when he came to visit and not ask him for anything. My decision was actually to not provide handwriting samples. What they wanted from me was, they gave me immunity and asked me for handwriting samples. This was a bizarre request because the government had, I assume, boxes or rooms full of my handwriting at that point in time. And so it was a symbolic resistance, really, not a literal resistance. I was being punished, really, although the grand jury law says that this is a civil proceeding and it is not punishing, it is mainly coercive. Yes, indeed, it was coercive. The same judge that held me in contempt and lectured me at the time, Judge Gattell, my children remember him because they thought at the time that he was the sheriff of Nottingham and, you know, the source of all bad things. Anyway, after 8 months, he accepted a ruling, to everyone's amazement, I think, to the prosecutor's amazement, that I was stubborn, recalcitrant, dogmatic, and would never change my mind. My recalcitrant mind was unchangeable, and therefore it had moved the grand jury subpoena from coercion to punishment, and so I was released. Various things happened to the other people who were subpoenaed with me at the time. Some were indicted under RICO charges. Some also, well, everybody else was ultimately released, of course. The time of the grand jury was invented, I'm sure you all know this, but I'm just briefly say it. It was a reform. It was a forward-looking step to limit the power of the king. And clearly, it has become its opposite. It is, in fact, a fishing expedition, pretty much unlimited fishing expedition by prosecutors who need no grounds, don't have grounds for an indictment, or they would indict. And so they're going looking for evidence that's given to them. And the thing that's interesting to me, that I found interesting, is that it's long been abolished in England, the grand jury, and it's abolished in the United States by about half of the states on the state level of the state grand jury. So it isn't, obviously it's not needed, there's nothing necessary about it. It's a tool of the prosecutors that they simply don't want to give up. It enhances the power of the executive, but is in no way necessary to investigation or prosecution of crime. Obviously in this kind of case, it's about politics, not about crime. And it's about really sending a message that solidarity, global solidarity with revolutionary struggles around the world is not to be in the United States, that it will be punished, that you will pay a price for it, and so on. Some of you may remember that, I'm just going to tell you 10 other key things about the grand jury, because I think it's important that we actually, as organizers, everybody in this room, as organizers, be able to tell people about the reality of what it is. One is, it gives sweeping subpoena powers to prosecutors alone. They don't have to get permission from anybody to make the subpoenas as broad and as sweeping as they want to make it. Secondly, they use it to conduct an inquisitorial investigation, which means that, you know, they're looking for evidence, but not going in with evidence. Third, there's no defense counsel allowed in the room. When I went in to talk to the grand jury, these 21 years ago, is it 21 years? 19, I can't even remember. It's not that. 82. Is it only 30 years? Is it only 30 years? 29 years. Okay, it's 29 years. 29 years ago, when I insisted to my lawyers that I would go into the grand jury room and talk to the grand jurors. I was in there alone without my lawyer. Lawyers are not allowed in the room. The prosecutor is in the room. There's no judge in the room. And there's a bank of grand jurors sitting in jury seats like they do. And I just said to them, this is my name, this is who I am, and you can talk to me, and you can also ask the prosecutor questions. You can actually push back here. You can ask him what he's up to, what he's seeking, what he's looking for, why he's doing this. And you have authority, in other words. You don't have to be a rubber stamp, is what I'm saying. And of course, every one of them, I think there were 28 of them, kept looking at their feet, and I couldn't get anybody to look me in the eye at that time. They only hear prosecutors. They don't hear from anybody else unless somebody talks to them. The proceedings are secret, so you can never say when you come out. There's no record of what, I mean, there's a record, but it's not accessible to the public. So whether you cooperated or not is not obvious, which is why I like not ever even going into the building. It's a very good tactic. The grand jury subpoenas, as you know, are the grand jurors are never instructed on the law. They never have to be told what charges are being looked into or what the nature of the law is. They're not screened for racial animus or for any other kind of bias that they might have. So there's no way to know really what a grand jury is about or who's a target. And that's really what makes it so clear that it is about a chilling effect. As you all know, that it's well known that people have said famously, that gets quoted again and again, that you could indict a bologna sandwich. A prosecutor could indict a bologna sandwich because there's nothing really required except the tacit silence of the grand jury. Couple of other things since that time. You'll remember that I always felt Monica Lewinsky's mother, do you remember her being subpoenaed and going in and talking about what her daughter told her? Why? I mean, why wouldn't you just say, anyway, it always struck me as a dramatic example of talking to in a way that you don't have to. But of course, resistance to federal grand juries goes back to the Nixon administration. There were something like 50 grand juries in a 3-year period in the 70s, targeting the vets, the Vietnam vets against the war, targeting certainly the Weather Underground and all kinds of anti-war forces, and tremendous resistance, people willing to go to jail, people going to jail, people refusing to cooperate. This was under Attorney General John Mitchell. So this round of fierce resistance is focused, according to the media, on solidarity with Palestine and Colombia. And of course, Carlos Montes, co-founder of the Brown Berets, was arrested and charged, not subpoenaed, last May. So he is part of us, part of this room, part of our solidarity. And even though it wasn't a grand jury resistance, he's been arrested for 6 felony counts and is ridiculous felony counts, I have to say, and has posted bail and is out, apparently, for his solidarity with the Colombian struggle. I want to make one other note about this terrific resistance that's been built here. I think it's important to see it as part of a broad resistance around criminal justice and the national security state that we live in. Because if we see, we're in the dilemma of having tremendous amount of great organizing going on, but often under separate umbrellas or under separate organizational names. So I just want to point to the devastating and really hideous state execution of Troy Davis this week, but the other side of that, if there could possibly be another side, the incredible global resistance. I can't think of a case, I don't know what comes to your mind, since the Rosenberg case, where there was that kind of international solidarity. I just spoke with a friend in the Netherlands who had mobilized rallies. I spoke to a friend who is in Argentina right now at a global death penalty conference and said the entire thing is about the amazing solidarity that arose around the world for Troy Davis and to prevent his execution. So I think we're at a moment, Illinois can feel a little bit of pride that we abolished the death penalty last year. I think we should feel pride about it, but I think we're at a moment to really take it down in the United States, and the fact that Rick Perry and the right wing is making it an issue means that we should be there. This is an educational opportunity. It's an opportunity to win people, and I think it's important that all of us participate in that along with this. And of course, the same is true about mass incarceration. There's no question that Michelle Alexander is built on the work of Angela Davis and critical resistance and all the people who've been doing prison work for the last decade, 3 decades, and it has really also lit a spark among people who realize that it's, what the system of mass incarceration is. Of course, the new Jim Crow and a very racist way to suppress resistance and to remove a huge section of the labor force from the population and keep them permanently disenfranchised and out. And torture and, you know, maxi prisons and on and on and on. I think, you know, here we are within 2 miles of Cook County Jail, where there are over 9,000 African American and Latino young men and women incarcerated. You know, we are an insane and sick society. It also can't be sustained economically at this moment. And I think there's movements and opportunities for us to link our struggle here with all of those. So I'm hopeful, another great year, using this to move forward. Lots of activists, insurgents, and rebels in the crowd. Terrific to see you, and congratulations to all of you.
Thank you.